This program is brought to you by RTS on iTunes U from the Distance Education Department of Reformed Theological Seminary. For more information on RTS degrees and programs, please visit us at www.rts.edu or call 1-855-854-6920.
The third of the Christian atheists, isn't it interesting again that all these schools of thought seem to have three prominent members, Altizer, Hamilton, and Van Buren now. Van Buren is a different kind of figure. He comes out of the tradition of, although he's a student of Barth, he comes out of the tradition of British analytic philosophy. We'll talk about that later, the philosophy of language analysis. And the philosophy of language analysis in one of its phases, the phase that's known as logical positivism, developed the argument that the term God is a misleading term. It appears to be a name for a being, but it really isn't, it really can't be, because the relationship between God, the term, and the being cannot be tested, cannot be verified. So Van Buren works that argument, works some other ones. Later, Van Buren went through some other phases, and he's not a very interesting figure, but he was often listed with Altizer and Hamilton as members of the Christian atheist school. Now, a more significant figure that I'd like to talk to you about is Dietrich Bonhoeffer, and I hope I don't offend any of you, because I know that if you're anything like me, you've been blessed by Dietrich Bonhoeffer. You probably read his Cost of Discipleship and his book Life Together, maybe his book called Ethics. And Bonhoeffer certainly is a hero in a way. I mean, he was involved in a plot to kill Adolf Hitler in World War II, and shortly before the war was over, Bonhoeffer was executed for his role in this plot to kill Hitler. And so he's a martyr. And I don't want to deny him any honor for that. I think that he did the right thing, by the way, in the plot to kill Hitler. If you want to know why I think that, take my ethics course someday. But Bonhoeffer is a really challenging figure. He warns us against the idea of cheap grace. Our salvation is by grace alone. Our salvation is free, but it was costly for Jesus. And discipleship involves taking up our cross and following Jesus and being willing to endure some level of sacrifice on his behalf. So so Jesus is important for us. And I have been moved by that teaching of Bonhoeffer. But where Bonhoeffer comes into the history of theology is in his later years, when he was in prison, by the way, when he was in a Nazi prison. He wrote some letters and papers from there that were later published and are very perplexing, very, very confusing, I would say. But they had a certain influence on theologians. That's why, kind of like as we did with Kierkegaard, I'm taking Bonhoeffer out of chronological order. Bonhoeffer, of course, died in 1945, but his influence on theology didn't really take wings until the 70s. Now, of course, his popular books like Cost of Discipleship and so on, people started reading those right away. And my youth leader back in the 50s was recommending him and so on. So he became a source of frequent sermon illustrations. But by the 70s, people started reading these letters and papers from prison, and they started talking about Bonhoeffer in very serious ways as an influence on the movement of theology during that period. So let's look at this a little bit. I pointed out to you why I'm treating him out of historical sequence. Bonhoeffer, a lot of people are perplexed about him. I think that you can make more sense out of Bonhoeffer if you see him as a disciple of Barth. He's very close to Barth in his thinking and in his training. He was, as Barth was, he was a leader in the Confessing Church during the Hitler years. That is the church that refused to be subservient to the Nazi regime. And of course, they moved underground for the most part. Bonhoeffer was the head of an underground seminary during that time, beginning in 1935. He had the opportunity to leave Germany, had the opportunity to teach in America, might have taught at Union Seminary in New York or Princeton Seminary in America, but he decided to stay in Germany, where his influence was most needed. He was arrested in 1943 for his plot to kill Hitler, and while in prison wrote these letters and papers. Now, what's important to Bonhoeffer? First of all, for Bonhoeffer, it's important to see Christ as the center of life. We know God only in Christ. And this is an emphasis of Karl Barth, and I think Barth twists that in a way that is unfortunate. But practically speaking, devotionally speaking, this is a good point to make. We know God only through Christ, and so Christ has got to be the center of our life. Christ is the one, our standard of what is possible and what is not. He's central to all aspects of our life, and not just to the religious things that we do, not just to our church attendance and Bible study and all. The being of Christ, now when Christ came into the world incarnate, he was the man for others, okay? He lived for others. And that is what he is. Now, like Barth, Bonhoeffer doesn't want to distinguish between what Jesus is and what he does, between his person and his work. Bonhoeffer says what Jesus does is what he is. And what, the Christ that we worship is the Christ who came and lived for others. So that's his nature, and therefore that's the nature of God too. God is the one who is being for others. That is his immanence, but that is his transcendence also, and therefore by nature he is inclined to suffer for those who are oppressed. This is the God who is available for us in the present, and therefore in an important sense God is available in all aspects of human life, not just some. So far, you know, there's a lot of good here. I know there's some metaphysics behind it that I wouldn't agree with, but the rhetoric is at least good and instructive and sometimes inspirational. So similarly, the church, the body of Christ, is properly the church only when it exists for others, okay? The purpose of the church, the being of the church, is service. Service, not status, okay? And a lot of people writing on ecclesiology during that period picked up on that contrast. Service, not status. And I disagree with that, frankly. I mean, I think the church has a great status. Look at the 1 Peter 2:9, where Peter says that you are a chosen race, a holy people, a peculiar people, a people of God's own possession, and so on. That's quite a lot of status right there the church has with God, and I don't think it's right to disparage that or to negate that. But anyway, Bonhoeffer kind of does. And so he says that our being, we are the church only when we are serving others, and there's some truth in that too. Like Barth, he is opposed to, he says negative things about religion, okay? This is still going on. I got an email from somebody with a YouTube on it of a young pastor, young minister, who says, I hate religion, but I love Jesus Christ. Well, it's hard not to get caught up in the passion of all that. He's making some points that need to be made. I mean, what we are as Christians is not a lot of, I think what he's saying is that our, what we are as Christians is not a lot of formal attendance of this and doing this because it's traditional and so on, but really, loving Jesus and going out and serving Jesus and serving other people. And I love that. I think there's a kind of youthful vigor to that kind of message and all. But I don't like what he's doing to the word religion. And what he's doing to the word religion comes from Barth and Bonhoeffer. Religion is a good word, folks. Let's not take good words and redefine them to mean something bad in order to make a rhetorical point. I don't think that's a good idea. Religion is our practice of faith. James talks about religion. True religion and undefiled is to visit the orphans and the widows and to keep oneself unspotted from the world. Here, James is using the word religion to talk about some of the same things that Barth and Bonhoeffer are distinguishing from religion, okay? Religion is simply the practice of faith, and it's a perfectly good word, and I don't see anything wrong with it, and I don't like this way that people sometimes say, well, we're Christians, but we're not religious, or we're following Jesus, but we hate religion. I know what they're saying, and I agree with some of the ideas that come with that, but I don't recommend that to you. I don't think it's right to take a perfectly good word and distort it in that kind of way. But let's face it, that's what Bonhoeffer does, following Karl Barth. And so in Bonhoeffer and Barth, religion means self-righteousness. Religion means trying to achieve favor with God by your own good works. And that's, of course, completely opposite to revelation. That's opposite to what God has given to us. So, says Bonhoeffer, we shouldn't be trying to please God by our good works, but we should simply receive the grace and the wisdom that comes to us through revelation. I agree with that basic point, but I don't like that terminology that he uses. He says the focus on religion limits God's presence to one aspect of life, namely the time that we're in church and praying and so on. Maybe so, maybe not. I agree that we shouldn't limit our focus in that way. And he says this use of religion leads to speculation, legalism, denial of responsibility, privatization, making religion a private thing. But of course, it can also mean making it too public, focusing entirely on formal church services. And religion, he says, focuses on God's power rather than God's suffering, powerlessness, and service. Well, maybe so, but I don't think so. I don't think that the word religion requires any of that. Well, but if we're going to renounce religion, what do we affirm in its place? And rather surprisingly, And this comes in his later work, and this is what got the theologians interested in Bonhoeffer. They weren't all that interested in the cost of discipleship, but this later stuff coming out of the letters and papers from prison, Bonhoeffer says, we're rejecting religion, but we're embracing secularity, okay? We're embracing secularity. And so Bonhoeffer represents the beginning of what's sometimes been called the theology of secularization. This is, if you turn from the religious, then you affirm the secular. Okay, it seems like a natural contrast if you adopt that terminology. Of course, I'm against that terminology, but if you say that religion is bad, what's good? Well, it's the secular that's good. Bonhoeffer actually uses some Bultmannian rhetoric here. He says the modern world is able to get along without God. Scientific advance renders less and less important the need for God as a hypothesis. Society is becoming more and more secular. And he says we live in a world come of age. Now, you'd expect a Christian to say, we ought to resist that. We ought to resist secularization. But, says Bonhoeffer, rather surprisingly, these secular developments ought to be affirmed, not resisted. Why? Well, because if we resist secularism, then we're claiming status, all right? We're claiming to have something that they don't have. We're claiming to have an idea that should be ruling over them. We're trying to put them down because of their secularism. And that's not a good thing. So if we're going to renounce status for ourselves and adopt a position of service, then we need to embrace what the world embraces. We need to love what the world loves, and that means to love secularism. God, he uses various theological motifs. God is what? God is the God who forsakes us. Psalm 22, which Jesus speaks on the cross. Therefore, while God has forsaken us, and I suppose I can understand how somebody living in World War II might think that God had forsaken his people, temporarily, but while God has forsaken us, we must learn to live without him. The secular world, does it have any value? Well, sure it does, because Christ entered into it, committed himself to it. Here there's a confusion, I think, between the value of the world as created by God and the value of the culture that is kind of a mixture of God's creation and man's sinful manipulation of it. We need to make distinctions here, affirming the creation but disaffirming the sinful side of it. But Bonhoeffer doesn't want us to make those distinctions. The sinful world has value because Jesus entered it, committed himself to it, and we can do no less. So we should be accepting our worldly duties and experiences. We should seek only to be human. We shouldn't be trying to transform the world into something Christian. Don't be preoccupied with the spiritual or the consummation as ends in themselves, but just try to affirm the secular world. Well, I think he's just plain wrong there. I mean, I can sympathize with somebody who's in prison and who's thinking about the end of his life coming soon and who's thinking hard thoughts about the nature of the world, the nature of sin and where society has evolved. And possibly Bonhoeffer was thinking about a world dominated by Nazism. Maybe the Nazis would win the war, who knows? And how do we live in that? But the idea of affirming secularism without any qualification, I think, is just misleading and certainly unbiblical. There is a polemic against worldliness in Scripture, and we need to balance that polemic of worldliness against the affirmation of what is good by God's grace in the world that He has made. So you can read some analysis there on the rest of this page and the next. This is part of a, I know I'm getting a little bit over time with my first hour, but there are other secular theologians, Harvey Cox, John A.T. Robinson, and so on. Cox is an interesting figure. He supplements Bonhoeffer's theological arguments with another one. Let me get that up here for you. Harvey Cox of Harvard. He also wants to affirm the secular in the world, and he develops his view of the Bible history this way: creation, God affirming the world, God affirming the secular. And again, there's kind of an ambiguity in the term secular here. What does secular mean? Does secular simply mean the material? Does it mean the created world? Or does it mean sin? Does it mean society? Does it mean culture? What does it mean exactly? But anyway, Cox basically says God affirms the creation, and so God affirms the secular. Creation, God affirms the world. The Exodus is the desacralization of the Egyptian pharaoh, desacralization of the nature gods of Egypt, okay? God has a sovereignty over the Nile and over the flies and over all the things that the Egyptians worshipped. Sinai, the way to God is through morality, not through religious rites. The incarnation, salvation is in the arena of secularity, where God comes into the world and affirms the world by coming into it. Well, again, there's this mixture of the truth that God affirms the creation, but confusion of saying that God affirms what sinful man has done to the creation. I have this reference further down the page, the Hartford Affirmation of 1975. And what this is a conference that was held on the date that I mentioned there, a conference of a number of theologians, and some of them are from liberal backgrounds, some of them are from evangelical backgrounds, some Roman Catholic scholars, Eastern Orthodox, and you see some of the names there, Richard Mao and Lewis Smedes, both from the Christian Reformed Church, also the very liberal William Sloan Coffin, sociologist Peter Berger, Roman Catholic scholars Avery Dulles and George Tavard, George Lindbeck, one of my professors at Yale, kind of a liberal Lutheran, was there. And what is interesting about this conference is that what they want to do is they want to say no more. They sort of want to reinstitute the conservative drift, all right? They're tired of the radicals. They're tired of people coming along and pretending that they, as theologians, that they can be theologians while denying most everything the church has ever believed. And so they're concerned about Bultmann, they're concerned about Tillich, they're concerned about Christian atheism, obviously, and they're concerned about secular theology. And they want to renounce those movements. And so they publish a document called the Hartford Affirmation. And the Hartford Affirmation lists, let's see, I'll give you the next page here. Lists what they call false themes of modern theology at that point. And I think these themes are overstated. I think they're straw men for the most part. I think most anybody would say they don't believe any of these things and or would not affirm them without a lot of modification. But this is the way modern theology was beginning to look to a group assembled, to a kind of ecumenical assembly. And, you know, like the past ecumenical councils, they want to say what's true and they want to place anathemas or curses on what they think is false. And so they state the falsehood and rail against it. Well, here's some of these things. Number 1A, modern thought is superior to all past forms of understanding reality and is therefore normative for Christian faith and life. Now, even Bultmann didn't say that modern thought was normative for Christian faith and life, but anyway, B, religious statements are totally independent of reasonable discourse. See, religious language refers to human experience and nothing else. God being humanity's noblest creation. Okay, well, you can look through those. Overstated, but in a way, basically what this is a repudiation of secular theology, a repudiation of God as dead theology, a repudiation of the whole movement of popular, fashionable theology up until that point.
The preceding program has been brought to you by RTS on iTunes U and may not be reproduced or disseminated in part or in whole, for sale or for profit, without express written consent. For more information on RTS degrees and programs, please visit us at www.rts.edu or call 1-855-854-6920.